Okay. So, and then I'm just going to, I'll shut this down. So today we're going to be talking about Glenn Coulthard's book and the issues of political action and analysis of the question about strategic actions. How does strategically put Aboriginal rights and title into play? And taking a look at the frame of reference that Glenn has used in his book. Glenn Coulthard is a faculty member in political science, First Nations and Indigenous Studies here at UBC. Some of you may have had the good fortune of taking a course with him. I don't know. So for some of you, this might be old news. But there's a couple things I want to do. I'm essentially going to do a close reading of some of the opening chapter in this book, and then take a look at his tactical approach or basic principles in his conclusions. And as part of this, what we were going to look at is this little video that a group of students of mine in a film course put together in I Don't Know More, but given that we can't get the sound to work, you won't see that. And I'll talk a little bit about the I Don't Know More as a political expression of Indigenous interests, and that will bring us to some of the tactical approaches described in Glenn's book. Yeah? Coulthard. Okay. Now, one of the things in this book to take note of is there's a deliberate reference to an earlier writer, Frantz Fanon. We're writing the title, Red Skin, White Masks. It's a direct play on Fanon's early 1950s, I think came out in the 1950s, black skin, white masks. And it's a direct kind of referencing to that, and he relies upon and draws upon Fanon's work quite extensively in setting up his case and his argument. And to a certain extent, the justification and the explanation for what you might call the idea of indignation as being a critical aspect of political struggle. Just as a side note, a few years ago in Europe, a rather elderly gentleman, I think in his 90s at the time, penned what became a very, very popular pamphlet in French, but basically talking about using the frame of indignation, or the indignant. In English, it doesn't quite have the same ring as it did in the French, but it became a kind of claim that there's a relevance and importance to a kind of a sense of indignant anger. Not so much self-righteous anger, which has a different tone, but this notion of indignation that drives political actions. But anyway, Fanon also you need to know a little bit about Frantz Fanon. And I've mentioned him once or twice in the past during the course. Fanon was a psychiatrist. He worked in Algeria. He also was a member of the left, of the revolutionary left, in that context. And one of the things that he saw working in Algeria was the ways in which mental illness manifests itself culturally. And part of his argument came when he came to realize his particular twist on Marxist theory was that the political struggle to decolonize was not simply a political or economic act. It involved the act within the cultural realm because of the way in which colonialism diminished and attacked people's ability to have dignity, self-dignity. And so that was an interesting adaptation that came out of looking through his direct practice and day-to-day struggle. He also was very much an advocate that political change did not come just simply through quiet negotiation, peaceful discussions, where everybody had to sit at the table and be polite. He essentially argued, to in varying degrees in different works, that there was a necessary element of violence in any political regime change. Now, in the context he was writing about, was a situation of armed colonial occupation, where you had an army of occupation sitting there. He was also writing in the period immediately following World War II, in which Europe and countries like France, and he was part of the Francophonie, which had engaged in armed resistance against the German invasion of Western Europe and Northern Africa. So he was writing in a particular moment in which there was serious and significant armed combat and armed occupational forces. One might argue that there's a slight difference in the North American context, though clearly when we look south of the border, the 49th parallel, and see the way in which American police forces have militarized themselves, the argument that it's simply a peaceful difference of opinion between people might, I think, could be seriously questioned. So he argued, now Coulthard modifies that and suggests that it's that people who characterize Fanon as being simply about violence as part of the overthrow are misreading or mischaracterizing the totality of his work. Okay. But if, when you think about the idea of change, if one is deriving a privileged benefit from access to a particular type of power, it's very unlikely that people just willingly give that up. There requires some element or some type of force or course of direction is required to actually enact change. I'm hesitant to suggest it's human nature that we don't want to give up something that we benefit from, because I would suggest that there is a malleability to human nature, that it's not actually set and structured right in the genes and it's marked there forever. But there is this element when people have power, they're unwilling to relinquish it, and there has to be ways in which that becomes dislodged. And even one can make suggestions that particular moments of shift and change, both individually and collectively, require some kind of force, some kind of disruption to knock people off the path of the path of inertia that propels people along. If for a moment you step outside the political realm, you take a look at the narratives in, say, personal sports and fitness, there's a whole genre of writing that talks about how, and these happen to typically are mostly middle-aged men who are writing these books, they've gone along, like this one guy, Rich Roll, who's an ultra-marathon runner, who goes along talking about, there he was in his 40s, he'd gone through a decade of boozing and binging in his undergraduate years and his early years as a lawyer. Then once he kicked his excessive alcohol consumption, he then kind of went into a period of another 10 years of binging and boozing on fast food. And as his weight was cramping up and up and up and up, he found himself walking up the stairs of his house one day, and he just literally found himself shaking in a cold sweat. He could barely make it up two flights of stairs. And that moment of realization, that physical force interrupted, sort of physically disrupted him, caused him to make a change in his life. It wasn't an easy change. So the point here is there's a whole sequence of what causes people to make changes, to shift direction. Often requires some kind of force or shift. It doesn't just necessarily happen. It's not about willpower. It's not about thinking the right thoughts. It's not about exhorting people to do the right thing. There often comes a time, something happens. And a lot of times in political struggles, engaging collectivities, there's a sense either of not so much distress or trauma, because as we've seen in looking at the residential school situation, the impact of collective sense of trauma really didn't propel change. People found it hard to shift, and the people most upset, most injured, according to Neeson, found themselves unable or incapable of action. So it's not so much that drives action as a sense of kind of an indignant, where people get developed with the words enough. where they have still have the capacity to act and do something. And so if you take a look at what's happening in the Central Coast right now with the Heltze, who've engaged a combination of legal struggles, they weren't totally successful, direct political action, they occupied the Department of Fisheries offices there locally, and the willingness to put that kind of direct action into action, not just with the DFO, but also to serve notice on the commercial fishermen who are there. Those kinds of actions over time would require enough people to actually have that sentiment. And oftentimes what causes it, just things are going along, and this is, we can't do it anymore. And people get to that point. And if there is an idea in people's mind about what they could do, that provides the spark or the possibility of organizing and shifting directions. So that's part of what Coulthard's talking about in this book. From a theoretical point of view in his argument, he uses a Marxist frame of analysis, which is not particularly normal in a lot of indigenous theorists. There are some indigenous theorists who will argue that Marxism is yet another Western epistemological frame and therefore should be discarded with all the Western epistemologies, all the Western points. Coulthard actually pulls upon the notion of Marxist analysis, particularly in a concept referred to as primitive accumulation. Now, primitive accumulation is that period of capital accumulation under capitalism, or as capitalism is kicking off, getting going. It's seen to be that period where you're not actually directly expropriating value through the normal wage labor system or the relationship between labor and capital, but you're actually displacing people in some manner. So the phraseology of primitive accumulation refers to the older use of the notion of primitive and civilized, the idea of primitive as being before the fully formed notion of capitalism. Now, Coulthard takes that idea and he narrows it down to look at what's going on. And he makes a comparison between how value is extracted from workers in a capitalist economy. And he says in capitalism, in a sort of pure model of capitalism, time is taken from workers. Now that takes a little bit of explaining to say what does that mean. But essentially it rests upon the idea that when you are employed by, say in a factory, the classic model, you give labor power, or the time that involves your labor power, to the owner. And you're given some cash back, some payment for your labor power. But the profit that's extracted from you is, in a sense, that surplus time, that labor above. And so you're having time, your exploitation is occurring at taking time away from you. At time in terms of your productive capacity. In a colonial context, Coulthard says, the extraction occurs through a displacement of space. That the value is extracted by expropriating the space that the colonized occupy. And he says these are the similar processes, but they're working in different directions, so they have different implications. So if it's in a classic class relationship between worker and capitalist, the point of resistance is to organize labor power collectively and to take control over the work site. So that's that classic model. And Coulthard says, but the thing is that when you look at colonialism, the value is being extracted, it's about taking control of the land and extracting value from it in that manner. So the same kind of process, except you're looking in a slightly different direction, which means if you're going to resist colonialism as an indigenous people, you need to have some kind of land-based ethic, some land-based politics that ties you and to that place, and you can move from that place in terms of organizing your political struggle. And if you take a look at what's happening with the Heltzik right now, you can actually see that politic in action. So there's the linking between the legal rights and title that's emerged under the Canadian state, with their Gladstone case, which is one of the famous cases in the mid-19 90s had established some of the parameters of what defined an Aboriginal right and an Aboriginal title under Canadian law. It's tied to a community of practice, a group of people who share a history and an attachment to a particular place, and a set of practices, i.e. the harvesting of herring through roe and kelp, that's done in a particular locations that are tied to particular families. And furthermore, that extends not just to people who are living in Bella Bella currently, but to their relatives and family and friends in the urban centers, who then also mobilize their political support by going to the Department of Fisheries and Oceans office in downtown Vancouver, in Victoria, in other centers up and down the coast. And so, because of the connection that's maintained, on an interesting side note, you can trace, and one can trace, social relations within an Indigenous community through the distribution of key foods, like herring roe. So after the herring roe fishery would go forward, this thing, from many different communities, if you continue with the Bella Bella example, with the Heltsuk example, you would see shipments, people either putting it on a ferry, putting it on a float plane, passing it from one relative to the other through networks of exchange and distribution. And these are the same networks that connect people back to the place that become mobilized in these particular acts of political struggle. Also tied to this is a declaration of where the territory is and what they expect from it. A lot of the names have been mentioned in the news, and most of the news coverage actually on this is really the Vancouver Observer, which is an online paper with there's a former CBC reporter who's actually got himself up to Bella Bella and has been tracking this, and he's tied into a environmental network up there run by the McAllisters called Pacific Wild. So, I mean, there is also a kind of confluence with a wider environmental political movement occurring. So there's a sense of a tactical alliance between an environmental NGO as well as the First Nation themselves. So there's a coalition tactic, a strategy in place. The mainstream media, you got a little bit in the Globe and Mail, classically with Mark Hume, who comments, and it's popped up a little bit in the Vancouver Sun and the province. So in terms of news coverage on this, but the names that are mentioned, these place names, won't necessarily mean something. To say Larkin Point, for example, or Kitisou Bay, or Higgins Pass, Myers Pass, Spillner Channel, Seaforth, these names, which are the English names, not the Celtic names for these particular places. Kitisou is a Tsleil-Waututh name for a place, because there's a borderline between where the Tsleil-Waututh or Tsimshian communities and the Celtic, sort of the southern end of one and the northern end of the other, come together. But these names are immediately recognizable for the people who are connected to and tied to these areas through either memories and stories told to them, if they're not necessarily directly lived there, or from actual experience of being passing through these places, harvesting for different types of fish products. So that's an actual existing, right at this moment, political movement, political action. It's tied to one particular First Nation. It's tied to a their long-term strategic interest in maintaining control and asserting the authority over their fishery. Part of the discourse of that struggle has to happen in the language of science and ecology. And to a certain extent, I think that's unfortunate. I mean, and the reason I say it's unfortunate because it's a compelled necessity of the First Nation. So they are compelled by the context in the Canadian law to use the discourse of science to argue their case. Whereas I would suggest that's really irrelevant to the issue. It really shouldn't matter whether there is no herring stocks or lots of herring stocks. The issue should be who has the sovereign right to make the decision, which should rest with the Heltsuk in this case. But they use the language of science, and so they bring in outside consultants and fisheries people to suggest that the Department of Fisheries Oceans model of ecological processes is flawed, and that their stock assessment models don't really adequately address the reality in that area. And clearly, historically, the evidence indicates that there is far less herring today than there was even 50, 60 years ago. Well, actually, more accurate. Well, that's probably true, but the more significant date would probably be about 100 years ago, before the industrial fish meal herring industry really kicked off. So just a quick note on that. Herring and smelt-like fish and sardine-type fish have been harvested in this province since at least the late 1800s. Initially, there was a little bit of an attempt to fish ulukin commercially. Ulukin is the iconic fish on the coast, often called candlefish, which creates grease. We talked about it once or twice. No Euro-Canadian market for that. No other market. It didn't work. Then they went to pilchards, massive pilchard fishery through the early part between World War I and World War II, basically destroyed the pilchards. But pilchards are also something, or often called sardine or anchovy, those three get linked in. We're at the northern biological extent of those fishes' ranges, and they have these wild cycles through long-term time, where the abundance will fly, go up, and then drop on a natural level. And of course, if you overexploit them, you just help drive that down. There is a modest sardine anchovy fishery in BC now, but it's highly regulated. But after World War II in particular, starting through the middle of World War II, after World War II, there was a massive industrial herring fish meal fishery began, and in which it really brought the, it destroyed the herring stocks in terms of the diversity. It really reduced the overall biodiversity of herring stocks on this coast. Yes? Question?
For the reason about how they have to base their arguments on scientific and ecological impacts,
In the Gladstone case, which is the Helta case, they argued that it was an Aboriginal tidal fishery to harvest spawn on kelp. I don't recall if I think it was focused on spawn and kelp. They didn't include the roe fishery argument as well. So there was a right established for spawn on kelp, which is what gives the Helta case just a little bit of legal edge under Canadian law. So it's different than in other places. There's only a few First Nations that have actually won in court a tidal fishery or a rights fishery.
So it's more of a short-term legal strategic reason to go with scientific?
It's because the Canadian law, because part of those, there's three sets of cases around the same time, Gladstone, Vanderpeet, and Sparrow, I believe, NTC Smokos, Sparrow. Now, I can't remember, I think Sparrow was a little bit separate. Anyway, those names aren't that relevant at the time. But the Sparrow decision set a criteria for what measured the importance. Ecology was first. So if the Department of Fisheries says there's an ecological risk for a species, that trumps everything else. Then it was an Aboriginal right for food, social, ceremonial. And in a few of the newscasts that's come out of Bella Bella these past few days with, I forget what the DFO officer's last name is, Sue something, I should remember it. But anyway, she's the Director General for the Pacific Region who flew up to negotiate with them. In a couple clips, she says, we will put certain areas of certain places within Area 7, which is the statistical management area that covers most of the Helta territory. We will put those off limit to the commercial boats to protect food, social, ceremonial. So DFO is well aware from their legal advisors that they have to protect the right for food, social, ceremonial over commercial. But the arguments then become what the Helta and other First Nations who've taken the DFO to court over have been. They've been putting the first test about the precautionary principle in play that the Sparrow decision determined, that you would have to find an ecological risk. So, but these become skirmishes along the way, and unless they seem to be linked to a wider term political process, they really won't achieve the idea of enactment of indigenous sovereignty. And that's part of what Coulthard is arguing for. How do you move in that direction? And in his chapter on the Denny land claims case, this book is in smaller print than some of the others. I just want to just wanted to pull out a quote I've got here. Okay. So this is on page 77 of this book, and it's in the second chapter. He says, if primitive accumulation represents the process of dispossession through which non-capitalist social relations are transformed or integrated into market ones, then it would appear that this phenomenon has gained considerable momentum in the North over the last few decades. So what that means, and that's a critical passage, but what that means, I'll explicate it a little bit here, is that he's arguing that the initial indigenous relations of production, how goods were produced, how you transformed energy from nature into something usable by human beings, that initial process was not part of a capitalist system. A capitalist system is based upon private ownership, the idea of alienating property, the notion that you can have, I can split a piece of property off, I could take this row of chairs and say, these are mine, cut them in half and sell one to you, one to you, one to you. In a certain sense, we're selling already. We're kind of selling you the right to be here by charging you tuition fees and jacking the prices up over and over and over again. So the higher the tuition fee goes in proportion to the actual cost of you being here, the more we are commoditizing this relationship, so that you are now purchasing a commodity and you expect something from it differently than if we were providing a social benefit, which would mean you wouldn't pay direct tuition fees at all. In the same way, K-12, it's not, you don't pay tuition fees in Canada or the U.S. unless you go to a private school. So he's saying in the prior existing indigenous frameworks, even ones that accumulated wealth, even in societies such as on the coast where you had these you had the idea of accumulating wealth and you had wealthier people and poorer people, they were not part of a capitalist market economy. And part of what the process of primitive accumulation under colonialism does is transform and take control of those relations. And one of the things that happens if you advance an indigenous title or rights argument, you tend to preserve a collective process of resource harvesting of access to land. In his chapter on the Dene land claims, he charts how they began in this political movement in the early 70s with a land-based policy that would made it very difficult for a capitalist market to occur in land in the north, to at the end of the process that shifted to a recognition-based politics in which there is reliance upon things like education, control over health care, certain lands that were granted and rights to consult in other places, but essentially removing the fundamental aspect of control. And what that does is through those agreements, the final agreements that are signed, liberated land for entry into the capitalist marketplace. So what it allowed for is by restricting and limiting the Dene's political rights under the Canadian Constitution, it cleared the land, like the old Scottish enclosure movements and enclosure movements in the UK of removing the peasant farmers from the land and concentrating them. It opened up that land and resources for being marketed and privatized. And that's the sort of primary critique he has of the practice of recognition politics. And just let me read one other point here. So, and this sums up this in a nice and succinct way. a reorientation of the indigenous struggle from one that was once deeply informed by the land as a system of reciprocal relations and obligations, what he calls grounded normativity, which in turn informed our critique of capitalism in the period examined above, i.e. in this period of the 70s and 80s that he's talking about, to a struggle that is now increasingly for land, understood now as material resource to be exploited in the capitalist, in the capital accumulation process. So you go from a situation which you still see existing in some First Nations communities, where you are existing in a reciprocal relationship in which the land and the things in it are like social beings which one has a relationship to. And therefore you don't have the right to sell. In the same way we have now, even under capitalist society, loosely, but not totally, accepted the premise that we don't sell other individuals. So there are points of play where you could suggest in parts of the world, and parts of even our own system here, that there is an element of selling of people. But you move from a point where you can't sell these things because your relationship to them, where that's been separated, and where the resource, the land itself, becomes land a thing that now can be subdivided and divided and can be entered into the capitalist economy. And so his argument and his point is to say, how do we hold that back? How do we stop that process? How do we take advantage of the social relations between people and non-human beings to understand these reciprocal relationships, where what he calls a land-based ethic is at the core of the political process. And that fundamentally inhibits the expansion of a kind of neoliberal form of capitalism that really doesn't care about people but only cares about certain types of profit. If you take a look at the North Coast and the Simpsonic world, where the system of house systems are in place, where there are matrilineal houses, and each Samoyed, each chief has a territory attached to his name, mostly his. Some named people, female people, also have territories as well. And in that context, if you want to have a development that goes over, say, 23 house territories, to negotiate access to that is very difficult if you have to sit down and negotiate through consensus basis. This is from a government proponent with the 23 different people to actually have access to that space. For a capitalist economy to function smoothly, you want to have somebody with an individual, preferably with executive capacity, to make the decision. Hence the reliance, and we talked about economic or impact benefit agreements. The desire to keep those in a particular direction away from the question of rights and title, but just to the transferring of benefits, and then to individuate or to commoditize those benefits. The key theoretical point that I would highlight here is this the way in which controlling territory, controlling space, becomes a driving force of a colonial regime. And Coulthard's argument is, we still exist within a colonial regime. That relationship has not been transcended. We are not in a post-colonial world here. Maybe in literary studies it's post-colonial. But in the economic and social reality of indigenous communities, this is a colonial world. And as we noted in the discussions about the Heritage Conservation Act, the way in which it's structured and designed is really it assumes capitalist development. On one level, that makes perfect sense. Except the language of the Act purports to be all about preserving heritage values. In the same way, the environmental assessment legislations all purport to be about preserving or maintaining or environmental qualities or mitigating adverse environmental impacts. But when you parse it out and take a look at what those pieces of legislation actually do functionally, is that they clear the way for the commodification of the landscape, the land and the resources within it, to remove the concern of individuals. The difficulty becomes when what you're also removing are not just wayward industrialized workers who can, with a drop of a hat, move from Toronto to Edmonton to Vancouver to Montreal back and forward, which is what capitalism prefers. They want us, capitalism as a system, I don't want to reify, but capitalism as a system requires the individuals to be able to freely uproot themselves and shift and move. Yet at the same time, we put lots of controls on labor mobility, and you might be hearing about in the news this morning how this is the deadline for something like 70,000 temporary workers who have applied. I think it's around 70,000, a good number of whom applied for permanent residency, but because of some sort of slowdown in the immigration offices, many of these people will be facing deportation. I don't know how you mass deport that many people. But it will be difficult and trying and anxiety-producing for a lot of people in this country with that kind of thing going on right now. So capitalism wants you to be able to move around and bounce things. And the problem is, if you happen to be from a community or group of people who are actually linked and connected to a particular landscape through history, practice, and ongoing contemporary engagement, you often act irrationally from a capitalist perspective because you're unwilling to move to chase the jobs. So that's what the land. So for colonialism to move it forward, to clear, you have to figure out how to clear people off the land. So the first stage of 20th century capitalism is about making essentially that stage of colonialism is about causing people to lose a sense of self-respect, undermining cultural practices. Attempt to programs of re-education and displacement through residential schools, legal frameworks that constrained and limited individual behaviors, infantilizing people in certain processes, i.e. criminalizing different types of behavior, everything from inordinately restrictive liquor regulation to hunting regulations, fishing regulations, and many of these things being criminal practices. And all of that was kind of like the core of the 20th century process, and that's what we're moving forward into is a more intensive space now, because that still didn't quite remove people from the way of development, to now moving to this massively ramped up process to try to commoditize all the relationships tied to the land and to therefore clear people finally from all these spaces. So land does offer some solutions, so it's not a completely distressing or depressing frame of reference. And one of his examples that he pointed to was the I Don't Know More movement that occurred a little while ago. And there's a couple of really unique things about that. The little film that I was going to show was focusing upon Vancouver. Some students, some were at UBC, some were at the Native Education Center. Some were the group. It was a little group of people who were involved in organizing, following through these particular activities. But one of the interesting things about the I Don't Know More movement is a lot of its roots, even though it spread to reserved communities, was urban. But 2/3 of our communities live in urban spaces today. The other thing that was about it is it was predominantly sparked by, at the core, a group of women activists. And female activists who became involved, which is not unusual within indigenous cultures and societies, but it was a very different type of politics than the classic Summit of First Nations, Assembly of First Nations, etc., with a different format style of politics. It also tended to be more distributed in the sense of the way, by through the use of media technologies, etc., to connect and control and to link people. These sort of fit off some of the theses of indigenous resurgence and decolonization. So, Glenn lists five. I guess I have 1 minute per each. to summarize for you here, but it's also in that reading this chapter. I'll just summarize them for us. Five theses on indigenous resurgence and decolonization. One, necessity of direct action. Taking direct action, he sees as being a critical a critical act. And this, there's actually a long-standing thing when I talked about the idea about what causes people to change or shift direction, that there's a whole body of work in thinking that people, you have to act. If you use a pop psychology thing, act your way into feeling better. but on a more serious note, there's this idea that it's through direct action tactics, both as a political tactical attempt at shifting things, as well as an engagement and transformation individually. He also talks, he has this thesis where he says, capitalism no more. And he says, you have to seriously start to begin to ask the question of what might an indigenous political economic alternative to the intensification of capitalism on and within our traditional territories take. There's an idea of thinking differently. And I mentioned a while back the writer Gibson Graham, who said part of the problems with critiques of capitalism is we often assume it's a totalizing narrative, that it's completely perfect, and in which there are spaces and holes and gaps within it. It isn't perfect. It isn't the only solution. And within the gaps, there's possibilities of doing things. And if you already are based in the land where you are, and there is a resurgence of people returning, not in a kind of 1960s, 70s-ish returning to the land, but there is a returning back to practices on the land that's occurring in many of the indigenous communities today. So there's thinking about how do you provision differently, how do you connect differently, how do you can you de-link from the global processes. The reality is global networks are a good thing and can be a good thing. In the same way that a backhoe can be a good thing, but it also can be destructive. How you use a tool is an important question, but it's thinking ways to de-link from the kind of nasty version of capitalism that most of you will have grown up under. And then the move toward trying to find ways to identify and expand the indigenous sovereignty within the city. Because oftentimes a lot of the politics is focused only on the reserve home community, not in the urban spaces where majority of people live. And Glenn talks about the critical importance of establishing notions of sovereignty within the urban spaces. And that's a complex issue because there's underlying indigenous rights within these urban spaces, as well as people who come from different communities living in these same places. Also, the importance of gender justice. And he has a very detailed and, I think, effective chapter where he describes the ways in which a lot of the contemporary ideas of gender, and he lays out the way in which the colonial laws structured the notions of gender that have become paramount. The fact that you have the difference between I don't know more leadership and structure and the Assembly of First Nations, the political leadership and structure, and the gender differences in these things, he would derives directly from the colonial and patriarchal nature of the establishment of the Canadian state. And unless we confront that, rather than assuming that the attitudes that we hold today might be the ones we want to have always held, he talks about the ways in which the constant onslaught of patriarchal legislation has, in a sense, shifted certain community perceptions of gender relations. And he says one needs to have a gender justice, as he calls it, as part of the colonialization. And then he says you have to look beyond the nation state, that the politics of nation-to-nation politics that are paramount today in First Nations politics, he says, often are limiting things. You have to, and that is probably the most utopian of his theses. But let me just say, read this thing. He says, I would venture to suggest that over the last 40 years, Indigenous peoples have become incredibly skilled at participating in the Canadian legal and political practices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He says, says, okay, does it require that we vacate the field of state negotiations and participation entirely? Of course not. Settler colonialism has rendered us a radical minority in our own homelands, and this necessitates that we continue to engage with the state's legal and political system. What our present condition does demand, however, is that we begin to approach our engagements with the settler state legal apparatus with a degree of critical self-reflection, skepticism, and caution that has to date been largely absent in our efforts. It also demands that we begin to shift our attention away from the largely rights-based recognition orientation that has emerged as hegemonic over the last four decades to a resurgent politics of recognition that seeks to practice decolonial, gender-emancipatory, and economically non-exploitative alternative structures of law and sovereign authority grounded on a critical refashioning of the best of Indigenous legal and political traditions. It's only by privileging and grounding ourselves in these normative lifeways and resurgent practices that we have a hope of surviving our strategic engagements with the colonial state with integrity and as Indigenous peoples. So he doesn't say leave the field of negotiations with the state, but it has to be grounded in the ethic of a land-based ethic and of a different perception, of a different vision of what the future should be. And with that, he ends on a somewhat optimistic note. So I hope you have a good long weekend. Looking forward to the senior poster presentations. If anyone needs any assistance with printing posters, if that's that's a question, please contact me by email, and that will have to be organized to be done on Tuesday in the lab, if that's an option you've selected. If not, there's a number of vendors nearby that you can choose a variety of different costs. And so the poster presentation will be Wednesday in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology building. We're no longer a department of. Then next Friday will be our Friday after we our last class, we do the in-class self-assessment reflection. Great. Have a good weekend, even though it's not quite the weekend yet.